And if you go to the Perimeter website, on the first page, look at it carefully, you'll see a link to the recordings of the lectures. So we can go and listen to the lectures a second, a third, a fourth time. And anything that the lecturers say can be used against them. Recorded for a posteriori. So you remember the first lecture when I said you guys are the jury in a court case, and you can go and listen. So that's different from the court case. But yeah, you can go back and listen if you haven't understood. So Jonathan is going to introduce this week's lecture.
Okay, so this week I'm happy to bring Sheldon Goldstein to you this week to discuss the Roy Bones interpretation. It could be a more different interpretation than the one you saw last week in the case of Playing Worlds. Professor Goldstein is a professor of mathematics at Rutgers University. He's worked on system mechanics and issues around ergodicity, and is also one of the leading experts on the Roy Bones interpretation. So with that, please welcome the speaker.
This one seems to have a mechanical problem. So the other ones, you start here, then you can move it up.
So this one stays down, this one stays here. Yeah. I can move this down first.
Yeah.
Well.
Here would be perfect. It would be more.
Thank you.
This is the interpreter.
I'd like to thank Joseph for inviting me here in the Perimeter Institute for its hospitality. I really enjoy coming to this place. First, some references. I guess much of what I'll be saying, at least there'll be some aspect of what I'm saying discussed in my article in the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, my article on Bohmian mechanics.
Well, those of you who haven't looked at the website, just recommend reading on the website for this week. Thanks, Carlos, for reminding me to do that. And this reference that Shelley threw down, and also Bohm's reading articles are available in PDF files on the website.
Maybe I should try this. I think it's here. It's better. This is online, this article. And there's a shorter article in, well, which will be in the Encyclopedia of Philosophy, also in Bohmian Mechanics, by myself and co-authors, Detlef Thur, Nino Zangi, and Robert Tomolka. So what am I supposed to be talking about? The Roy Bohm interpretation of quantum mechanics. First, in terminology. The Roy Bohm interpretation is often called Bohmian mechanics. And that's what I'll be mostly calling it here today, Bohmian mechanics. It was discovered by, created by de Broglie in 1927. And is there enough chalk? I'm going to run out of chalk.
There might be some on the upper boards.
Oh.
I'll go and find some.
There's really one there. and rediscovered by Bohm in 1952, or probably more accurately, 1951. Now, what is Bohmian mechanics, I guess, is the first question I should address. What? What it is the formulation of non-relativistic quantum mechanics. Good. I'd rather say formulation than interpretation, because it's really, I would say, sort of a different theory. It's since the things going on in the world are different and involves different mathematics. Some of the mathematics being totally absent in the usual quantum theory. It happens to make the same predictions as the usual quantum theory, and that's why people might tend to say it's really just an interpretation of the same theory of orthodox quantum theory. But I don't think that's a good way to think about it. Good way to think about it in situations, probably better, like, since you have lots of interpretations of quantum mechanics, I think it's probably more accurate to say you have lots of different formulations, different theories, which make the same predictions. Strikingly, it's kind of striking that this should be so. Now, one reason I emphasize the word formulation, I also want to emphasize one other thing about Bohmian mechanics. There are, by Bohmian mechanics, I mean a specific theory tied to non-relativistic quantum mechanics. And I mean to contrast that with lots of other theories which might be thought of as part of belonging to a Bohmian approach. So I'm focusing here today, and probably most of the time Thursday, on a particular version of a kind of approach, a Bohmian approach. It would be better to call it, I think, a Bellian approach for John Bell. Now, let me address the question of why is it needed? Why is it needed? What's wrong with the usual standard textbook orthodox quantum theory? I probably don't need to spend much time on this, because I imagine you've heard the story about what the usual theory says and what its problems are. But let me spend a little bit of time expressing this from my point of view. In one sense, the answer to this question is not very much. And in another sense, the answer is a great deal. Not very much is wrong in the following sense. If you regard orthodox quantum theory as a phenomenological formalism, a bunch of rules, regularities, a system of regularities described in an efficient way governing certain macroscopic regularities, relationships between results in one experiment and results in different experiments, something about phenomenological. Not focusing on what's going on the microscopic level, but really on an operational level. Relationships between results of experiments, it's a very fine, it does a very fine job of that. Nothing much wrong, maybe nothing wrong with quantum mechanics, understood in that modest way. But it's usually not understood in that modest way, and there's a great deal wrong with it if we understand it the way it was originally intended to be understood, as a fundamental theory, not a phenomenological theory. Quantum mechanics arose to understand physics at a deeper level than classical mechanics. And many physicists, if not most, believe that quantum mechanics should govern physics at the deepest level. That is the framework. It's not a modest belief. And I'm inclined to accept that as well, although I don't think I'd be able to defend it, because probably when we get to very, very small scales, why should quantum mechanics continue to be true? No good argument for that, but I'm still inclined to believe. I'm not a critic of quantum mechanics in that sense, although I probably should be more critical. As a fundamental theory, which is what it was intended to be, governing at the atomic scale at its inception, a great deal is wrong, I would say. And in a nutshell, the problem is this. The main problem is it's not clear what quantum theory is about. What does it describe? What kind of objects does it describe? What does it say about their behavior? One would naively, and I think not so naively, expect that if you have a theory, you should know what it's talking about, what kind of things it governs, and it should tell you in a fairly clear way how those things behave according to the theory. There are several possibilities which have been suggested for what quantum theory is about. Common view, and you heard about this last week, it's about wave functions. But you don't have to believe in Everett to think that quantum mechanics is about wave functions. I would think that's a pretty, very prominent view for just the physicist in the street. But when you learn quantum mechanics, the main thing you learn about, the thing which you seem to take really seriously, is the wave function. One says things like, the state of a system in quantum mechanics is given by its wave function. The basic equation in quantum mechanics is an equation for the evolution of the wave function. It looks like the theory is about wave functions if you just look at the structure of the theory. Schrodinger evolution, the basic equation, the basic evolution equation in any case. Well, what's wrong with that view? Or at least, why does it present difficulties? The main difficulty with the view that it's about wave functions is the measurement problem. Well, the problem Schrodinger's cat amounts to the same thing. And the problem is this, wave functions typically, normally, unless you're really crazily lucky, the wave functions, you'll typically get strange wave functions which involve, say, at the end of a measurement where a pointer might point left and or it might point right, two different possibilities of how the pointer would point, and you describe the whole setup, including the apparatus, including the pointer, quantum mechanically, then you end up in a situation where the after measurement wave function might be a superposition of a pointer pointing left and a pointer pointing right. From a normal point of view, that's hard to understand, to interpret. For Schrodinger, it was ridiculous. For Bohr, it would have been ridiculous, too. Or similarly, you might have a wave function. This should be the middle Bohr, right? You might have a wave function of the form psi equals psi for a cat in a box, psi alive plus psi dead. And here you have basically the same difficulty. So that wasn't the orthodox original Copenhagen view that what quantum mechanics is about wave functions. The original Copenhagen view, and in a sense it might be regarded as the view in textbook quantum theory, though it's hard to judge, is that quantum mechanics is fundamentally about not wave functions, but about measurements. Or maybe about observations. And that would be perfectly acceptable if quantum mechanics were merely a phenomenological formalism. But if it's to be a fundamental theory, this is not very plausible. The difficulty with this idea, quantum mechanics is a fundamental theory, which is fundamentally about measurements or observations, is, well, it is implausible that fundamental physics should care about such a human-centered thing as measurements or observations. Besides from that, the very notion of measurement observation would seem to be too vague to be part of a fundamental theory, which should be defined in terms of precise mathematical structures, not vague notions like measurement or observation. After all, measurement or observation are just some routine kinds of run-of-the-mill interactions between a system and apparatus, the sort of things which should be analyzable in terms of the more of the basic theory defined on a microscopic level. They shouldn't be part of the formulation of that theory, but something which can be understood in terms of the theory. But, and there's a big but here, there are strong arguments that you can't do better than saying that quantum mechanics is fundamentally about observation. And indeed, the no hidden variables theorems seem to suggest that in quantum mechanics, measurement creates reality. The normal understanding of the word measurement, what it really means is that measurement should reveal reality. You do a measurement to find out what was there, you do it, you learn something about the system. When we speak about measurement in quantum mechanics, we don't really mean measurement, we mean something more dramatic, but whatever we mean, it's something we do creates the reality which was not there before. In quantum measurements, we're not finding out what properties the system had beforehand. When we measure the position of a particle in orthodox quantum theory, we're not finding out where it was. We're causing it to be where we find it, so to speak. And no hidden variables theory seems to strongly suggest that that's the case. Not reveal, but create. Measurements create reality. My favorite, by way of version of the no hidden variables theorems for presenting, for conveying this idea, is Lucian Harvey's version. It involves four observables, A, B, C, four quantum observables, A, B, C, and D. They happen to be spin components for two spin one-half particles, but that really doesn't much matter. There's some fixed quantum state, fairly typical state for two spin one-half particles. In this state, quantum probabilities are such that the following things are true. It may be the case A and B could both be one. And that happens about, if you choose psi optimally, about 9% of the time. The probabilities are also such that whenever A is one, C is one. And similarly, whenever B is 1, D is 1. But the probabilities are also such that this has probability 0. This never happens. What I've written, these four relationships along the sides of that square or rectangle there, are impossible relationships. Obviously, if A and B are both 1, whenever A and B are both 1, which is 9% of the time, C and D would have to both be 1, 9%, at least 9% of the time then, not 0% of the time. Lucian, what's the reference for this?
Remember your reference by heart.
It's certainly PRL 94, is it, or 93? So is it clear that this is kind of puzzling set of relationships? And it's characteristic of the no hidden variables theorems. The no hidden variables theorems involve yet impossible relationships between various observables under consideration. Impossible relationships, not the individual relationships. There's no problem with the relationship A and B both being one. The totality of relationships there just can't all be true. Of course, they are true in quantum mechanics. They cannot be true, I should emphasize, this is critical, if measurement reveals reality. Because if measurement reveals reality, then you have the quantities A, B, C sitting within your systems, having the value beforehand, and then when you interact with it a certain way, for example, by measuring A, then you really find out what was there already. So you would have to consider simultaneously all of these relationships as holding, which they can't because they're incompatible, they're inconsistent. On the other hand, if measurement creates reality rather than reveals it, there's no potential for any conflict whatsoever. There's no reason why the reality created by an AB measurement should have any relationship to the reality created by a different experiment, an AC, AC experiment. The problem only occurs if measurement reveals reality, because you have, then have to consider all these things simultaneously, whereas if it creates reality, you simply have four separate realities created in four different ways, and there's no possibility. This, I think, is a very powerful argument to say the total hidden variable idea is hopeless. I want you to keep it then in the back of your minds that there is this argument, and try to understand how, at the end of the day, Bohmian mechanics, which is, after all, a hidden variable theory, exists, if possible, works. This would seem to be a very simple argument that nothing like it could possibly work. Okay. So now let me begin to address Bohmian mechanics. What does Bohmian mechanics say? Well, I raise the issue that the problem with orthodox quantum theory is that it's not clear what it's about. So probably the first thing I should do for Bohmian mechanics is say what it's about. These seem like simple words, what a theory is about. I mean, you may be striking, that seems kind of ridiculous, that the problem can really be so simple. One of the greatest difficulties in understanding things and foundations of quantum mechanics is thinking that it can't be on such a simple level that the problem arises. More often than not, that is the level. You've really got to get back to the ground with those basic kinds of things, like what is something about? Nothing sophisticated to get to the core of the problem. Otherwise, you're going to miss it. According to Bohmian mechanics, quantum theory, Bohmian mechanics, is about particles, literally particles, that is, things with positions, definite locations. In that respect, Bohmian mechanics is just like classical mechanics. Classical mechanics is about particles moving according to the classical equations of motion, Newton's laws of motion. Classical mechanics is a theory about particles moving in a certain way. Similarly, Bohmian mechanics is a theory about particles moving in a certain way. On this level, there's nothing puzzling about the fact the kind of theory we're talking about. It's just like classical mechanics. What's different is the way the particles move. It's an entirely different way. Bohmian mechanics is organized according to entirely different principles than classical mechanics. What is the state of a system in Bohmian mechanics? Well, if it's about particles, the state should include the particles. So there's the positions of the particles. For an n-particle system, there are the positions of those n-particles, q1 to qn, points in physical space in R3. Or for short, just the configuration Q. And it should come as no surprise that in addition to that, you've got the wave function, which is a function of the configuration steps and the positions of the particles. Really Q. No longer line. Notice that I'm distinguishing between capital Q and little q. Little q is just a dummy variable in the argument of the wave function. Something you already have, if you have a wave function, you have psi q as a function of the configuration space. In addition, then you have the actual configuration, something absent in orthodox quantum theory. In orthodox quantum theory, there's just this function on configuration space, psi. Here, in addition to that psi, there's something more, the configuration itself, the actual positions of the particles. And this something more is not a small thing, it's a big thing. It's what the theory is about. It's the key thing in the theory. From a Bohmian point of view, therefore, that orthodox quantum theory should lead to confusion, exceptional difficulty is no surprise, because from a Bohmian point of view, you're leaving out the guts of the story, what it's really about. Okay. That's what the state is, and then from here to get to Bohmian mechanics requires almost no work at all. Yes.
What, I'm sorry, what is the relationship between capital Q and small q?
Suppose, think of first of a single particle. Then there would be a field on space one little Q there. But in addition to that, there would be the actual position of the particle. So for a single particle, what you would have would be there's a wave function on space. And in addition to that, there's the actual position of the particle, which is not spread out. The wave is spread out, but the actual position of the particle is what it is at some point somewhere. Now replace this by configuration space, and let's say you have the same story. This, however, is a strange kind of theory, but the strangeness is the strangeness inherent in quantum mechanics. You have to take seriously, as an object in the theory, important physical object somehow, a field, function, on not physical space, which is a normal kind of thing to have, but on configuration space, which is a kind of funny kind of thing to have. But that's quantum mechanics. And Bohmian mechanics isn't altering that, it's just adding something fairly trivial, positions of the particles, to the description. The key idea behind quantum mechanics is the key corresponds to the key criticism that Einstein had with quantum mechanics. He insisted, Einstein, that the wave function could not possibly be the complete description of the quantum system. Something more is necessary. It became traditional to call that something more hidden variables. When I was a student, I thought that something more would be something rather exotic. Something would require, at best, great imagination, but more likely be impossible to find. Something that, because of the hidden variable theorems, probably couldn't exist anyway. I'm expressing my state of mind as a student. It turned out, in Bohmian mechanics, what we see happening is that something can be something totally obvious. The thing which requires absolute, the least possible imagination, if you're asking what could be the possible complete description of a system of particles. Well, maybe you should include the positions of the particles. It sounds so trivial to be unbelievable. But that is the essential point of Bohmian mechanics. Well, of course, any theory must involve some equations. Any dynamical theory must involve fundamental theory, presumably involve something like equations of motion. In Bohmian mechanics, will too. But the equations of motion are more or less immediately forced on you once you agree upon what the theory is about, positions and particles. So I guess I'll write over here what the theory says, what the equations are. There's the usual Schrodinger equation. And for most purposes, one can write it in this schematic form, where H is the Hamiltonian. It's also good to bear in mind what the Hamiltonian is for non-relativistic quantum mechanics. It's basically the sum over all the particles H bar squared over 2 minus H bar squared over 2. Gradient with respect to the kth particle squared, that is the Poisson with respect to the kth particle, that is the sum of the partial derivatives of the positions of the kth particle, over, I guess, mk, the mass of the kth particle, plus some function on configuration space, the potential energy function, which probably should be thought of in terms of, in realistic physics, Coulomb interaction or some other realistic interaction. For our purposes here, it doesn't matter what V is, what the potential is. So that's the usual Schrodinger equation for non-relativistic quantum mechanics. What?
Times sine.
This thing. Right. Thanks. Right. And I need one more equation for the evolution of the configuration, and that's this. The velocity of the kth particle, h bar over mk, times the imaginary part of psi star grad k psi over psi star psi. Psi is a function of q on configuration space. This here is a function on configuration space. You stick in the actual configuration, so capital Q, or Q1, Q2K here, Qn, you get a first order equation of motion. Qk dt is some velocity function of the positions of all the particles. The evolution of the configuration is given by some vector field on the right hand side.
So that's
expressible in terms of the wave function. Doesn't really matter. Psi is a function of little q, take the derivatives, but the little q, but then plug in capital Q into the function you get. Take the derivatives and plug in at the end. strange-looking equation, perhaps, but this pair of equations defines Bohmian mechanics. That's it. You add to the usual Schrodinger equation one more equation, the equation of motion for the positions of for the particles. And unlike in classical mechanics, it's a first-order equation, not a second-order equation. Accelerations are not playing a fundamental role in the formulation here. You don't have an equation for accelerations in the way I'm formulating it here, but equation of evolution, an equation for the velocity, rate of change of position. First order theory, simpler than a second order theory. That's it. That's the theory. What is orthodox quantum theory? How can we compare this with orthodox quantum theory? Some would say that orthodox quantum theory just involves one equation. But that's not textbook quantum theory. That's not what you learn. You have to learn orthodox quantum theory or teach it. This equation is not the hell, it's not the pain in the ass that the rest of the stuff you have to learn or teach is. That rest of the stuff is the measurement axioms. There's a whole slew of measurement axioms that you learn about. It's hard to learn them, and it's hard to teach them because it's difficult to say, to formulate in a coherent, precise way what they are. But you all know the story of eigenvalues, operators, eigenvectors, all that stuff. Measurements. Painful to do, but those extra axioms, which I've never actually, I don't know if any place were actually written down in a complete way. But orthodox quantum theory is Schrodinger's equation plus, we could talk about that, but it's hard, right? I've tried to, and it really gets, you really must irritate the students, because what's in the textbook is much simpler, but it just doesn't, even adequate as a phenomenological formalism. If you've ever had to teach quantum mechanics, you know what I mean. So there's a lot more you have to add to this equation to get orthodox quantum theory, and it's painful, both student and teacher. For Bohmian mechanics, there's only one more equation. It's not particularly painful for teacher or student, I would say. It's just an ordinary evolution equation. It's not the classical one. Okay, that is Bohmian mechanics. Now we have to talk about it. I first want to make a certain remark about the form that's written here. One important feature, it's a strange thing I did, by the way. Look, I have psi star over here, psi star over here, they cancel. Why the hell did I write it like that? Yes.
The probability current?
Exactly. That's one of the reasons I wrote it like that, to make the probability current manifest. What we in the numerator, we have the probability current for the kth particle, which you, I hope you've learned about. I'll say, if you haven't, I'll say what you need to know about it anyway. But this is what it is, the quantum probability current. The denominator is even more familiar. That's just the quantum probability density, psi squared. So one reason I wrote it in that form is to make this more manifest. There's another reason I wrote it in that form. Actually a fairly important reason. And that is, written in this form, the theory already takes care of not just the special case of non-relativistic particles, quantum mechanics, but spinless particles, no spin. This covers spin as well. Written in this form, you don't have to worry about spin. It takes care of itself. Automatically applies to spin. What do I mean? First of all, you do spin?
Not really.
Well, for spin zero, no spin, psi, let's say, what kind of values the wave function has? Just scalar complex numbers. Ordinary field on configuration space, complex value field, but still just numbers. For spin 1/2, and let me just limit the discussion to that. Psi, at least for a single particle, is not given by a single complex number, but a pair of complex numbers. Psi of q is given, therefore, by a pair of functions on physical space. Spinner value function, we would call it. The pair is a spinner. That spin 1/2, higher spin will involve more components. And if you have more than two particles, you have, you also have more components. You have to take tensor products in the various spin spaces. I don't think there's any need to go into that here. You know about it already, fine. If you don't, we don't have time to really go into it anymore. The important thing here is the following. If psi doesn't have spins, this is well defined, and but the psi stars just cancel anyway. This is also well defined because of the cancellation. No problem with this. The scale in the numerator, complex scale in the denominator, perfectly well defined. Then we take the imaginary part and get something real, no sweat. If psi is spinner value, you have in the numerator a spinner. It doesn't really make a lot of sense for the velocity to be a spinner. I don't know what that would mean. But worse than that, you have to divide by a spinner. I don't know what that would mean. But taking this bilinear expression here, sort of a local inner product in the spin space, converts the spinner, which has many components, to something with just a single component. This is interpreted here. At each point, you're doing taking a spinner inner product, which means you sum over the spin component. You have the first component of this spinner times the first component of this spinner plus the second component, sum of the second components. The second component of this and the second one, add. If you have many more components, sum over all those ones. Implied in this equation here, when you're dealing with spinners, is a sum over all the spin indices, how many you have, however many you have, similarly in the denominator. So the equation, what you naturally write down, makes sense perfectly for spin. Okay, that. If in fact, however, we don't have spin, let me rewrite the equation in perhaps a more familiar form. So this is for spin zero, no spin. The velocity is h bar over mk, imaginary part of Brad k psi over psi. And this is, in fact, the gradient of the phase function divided by the mass of the k particle. Where now I'm writing the wave function, psi, in polar form. That is to say, there's a real amplitude, the massive value of the wave function, and something which involves a phase of the wave function, either the is over h bar. R and s are real. In fact, r is to be thought of as positive, s is real. So this is called the polar decomposition of the wave function. This s here is this s here. And when Bohm originally wrote the equations down, or de Broglie, was probably in that form. So that's the more perhaps more familiar form. It's not a good form for what, because it doesn't apply to spin. It's not a great form, at least. I think that's a better form. Now, there's a very important consequence of the Schrodinger equation. Almost, I guess, in most courses in quantum mechanics, probably the first consequence one derives from the Schrodinger equation. And it involves J and rho, and it's the quantum continuity equation. J rho dt plus, how do I want to write this? Let me write it first in somewhat schematic form. Divergence of rho times J equals zero. Where this divergence of rho times j is the sum over the divergences for all the particles of the rho, not j, no rho here, j, where the sum of the divergence of the kth component of the current, sum over all the particles. Yes?
Can you say again what rho is?
Rho is psi squared.
Oh.
It's the denominator. Psi star psi. Yes.
But isn't there a psi for each? Isn't there psi k or is psi?
Not a, so the crucial thing, there were two steps one could have taken in the initial days of quantum mechanics. I think it's likely, I mean, somebody can, it must have been the case, the history. First, you get in a certain formulation of quantum mechanics, a wave equation, at least, for a single particle. Having gotten back, you try to extend your result to many particles. The natural thing to do is if you've got a wave equation for a single particle, each wave, the particle has its wave, it would probably be natural to assume that you have many particles, you have many waves. That might have been natural, but it wouldn't be mathematically very good. It would be a pain in the ass. It wouldn't work. What turned out to be better to do, what actually does work, what gives you quantum mechanics, is to say, notice that, well, a wave function for a single particle is a function on the configuration space of that particle. If you have many particles, you just take the wave function on the bigger configuration space for the many particles. So at the end of the day, there's still a single wave function even if you have many particles. One side. So the state here, if you have n particles, there's q1 to qn, the positions of all the particles. There is not psi1 through psi n, the waves for all the particles. It's absolutely essential to quantum mechanics. There's still one wave. On, however, configuration space, a much bigger space than for a single particle. R3n, the configuration space for n particles, versus R3, basically physical space. High dimensional space. You have a wave, a field, a function, a spinner value thing, more generally on a very high dimensional space. So this is the quantum continuity equation. And it's somehow supposed to express in orthodox quantum theory the way probability flows, whatever that means, in orthodox quantum theory. What it does have as a direct consequence is that the integral rho, what we call in orthodox quantum theory, the total probability, does not change under the evolution. So that's basically how it's used. Okay. Let me mention a few facts about this theory and underline a few facts. First of all, fairly trivially, it's the deterministic theory. So it's given by differential equations of motion, ordinary differential equations for the positions of the particles. Where are they? Partial differential equation for the wave function. First order in both cases, which means that if you specify the appropriate initial data, which will determine the future or the past, is the wave function at time zero, the initial wave function, together with initial positions of all the particles, the initial configuration. If we take this as the initial state, the initial state determines, according to this theory, the state at all other times. It's deterministic theory. One way to think about the evolution is the following, sometimes useful. The evolution equation for the wave function does not involve the actual configuration, because after all, this is the usual evolution equation for the wave function, and in the usual theory, there is no actual configuration. So you can think of first solving this equation for the wave function, then you get it for all configuration space for all times. So that you can have the right-hand side of this equation defined over all of configuration space for all time. So you have the right-hand side of this evolution equation for the configuration space, for the configuration defined for all time. Just so you have defined for all time a first-order differential evolution equation of motion for the configuration, which, given the initial configuration, determines configuration of all later. Okay. I should have said before that among the axioms in quantum theory, one of them are called measurement axioms, which you add on to the Schrodinger evolution, is the collapse of the wave path. That's considered to be kind of important and somehow makes sense of the usual theory. And Everettian people work very hard to argue that you don't need to do that. But in standard textbook quantum theory, that's one of the issues. You have that, that's one of the axioms. Collapse of the wave path. And it's puzzling because you have two sets of axioms. One is an ordinary evolution equation, Schrodinger's equation. Another set of axioms involves a different evolution equation involving collapses of the wave function, which would seem to be incompatible with Schrodinger's equation. Another aspect of the measurement problem. Notice that in Bohmian mechanics, There is no collapse of a wave function in the formulation of theory. The other wave function simply evolves that way. There are no special circumstances in which it is supposed to collapse. There are no additional rules saying that if you do a measurement, the wave function collapses. There's nothing like that in the formulation, in sharp contrast with the usual text. Okay.
Sorry.
Yes.
Is this a
continuity
equation?
Quantum continuity equation.
Where is it coming from? Is it just a consequence of the...
It's just a consequence of the top equation of Schrodinger's equation. It's a fairly standard consequence. It would just take a few minutes, but I don't think I should take the time to do it here. It's a standard consequence of Schrodinger's equation. Just plug in and compute.
We'll put this in the SI.
Yes, good. Yes.
Are you going to expand on that?
Yes. I want to first, before expanding on anything, I want to set up a problem. You should be puzzled because, you know, you kind of think collapse is important. And here you just don't have it at all. Let me emphasize something else. Said it, but I should say it again. This is it. That's the theory. There's no other, taking with a grain of salt, no other axis. That's it. I think the normal reaction of this theory, no other axis, okay, fine, we've done some crazy theory, but it should have nothing to do with quantum mechanics. We all know from quantum mechanics, particles can't have positions moving in some hokey way like that. It's ridiculous. It's some theory. It describes a strange kind of world with particles moving in some weird way. But why should it have anything to do with orthodox quantum? That would be a normal reaction, same reaction. I consider not such a normal reaction the following. I don't care. Who cares? I don't care if it works. Why do I care? I don't, that's a different kind of reaction. You don't understand so well. No other axioms in particular, no measurement axioms. I want to say a few words about the derivation of the theory. The derivation from what? You can't really derive it. You don't derive what you create, invent. But what I mean by derivation is how would you come up with this extra equation of motion here? I mean, somehow one derived, you want to arrive at Schrodinger's equation. I don't want to really get into that, how you got to that. The question, where would you, why would you write that stupid thing down? Let me call this equation the guiding equation. It expresses how the wave function guides the particles, choreographs the motion of the configuration. Where the hell does that equation come from? There are about 8, 7, lots of things you might think of trying to figure out. What kind of equation of motion should I write down? Lots of different approaches you might take. Surprisingly, all of the sensible approaches, anything you do which isn't crazy, or just chosen, something you might choose just to make it, get something wrong. Anything you do which is normal, it's going to lead actually to the same equation, this equation. I don't have time to mention all 6 or 7 possibilities. I'll mention a few of the ways you might proceed. One is the following. It's most obvious. What's already on the board? You're looking for you haven't just with Schrodinger's equation. You already have a J in a row because, as I said, the first consequence of Schrodinger's equation in textbooks is that rho, you have psi squared, quantum probability curve J, and it satisfies this equation. You already have a J in a row in standard theory. And you want to figure out what the velocity should be. The velocity. You have J and rho, you want to know the velocity is. It doesn't take any imagination. Since J, classically, is rho times V, you say V equals J over rho. No imagination whatsoever, and that's Bohmian mechanics. That's the first derivation. How one would have gotten to this equation by just doing the most naive thing imaginable. I'll mention one other possibility, without going into any detail. If you're looking for an equation of motion for the positions which you're insisting quantum mechanics should be about, And you already have a wave function evolving according to Schrodinger's equation. And you have the idea that the wave function is somehow going to be relevant to the motion of the, what the theory is about. It better be relevant. Otherwise, it couldn't possibly have anything to do with quantum mechanics. Wave function is crucial to quantum mechanics. It better be relevant to the motion. So you're going to look for the simplest kind of equation, which is sort of sensible. Simplest kind of equation of motion. Now, first order, I think, is arguably simpler than second order. And if you insist that the evolution for both the pair psi and q satisfy the same symmetry that you have in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, which is Galilean invariance, one is led rather straightforwardly to this form as the simplest possibilities. You might try that yourself and ask, how would I write down an equation of motion depending on psi, which is Galilean invariance? You should end up here. I don't think I should make that a homework problem, but actually you could probably do it. You just end up with that form. Or better, probably simpler, the form with this form. But I don't want to go into detail about this.
If you're going to have a position as a variable, and you have a first order differential equation, no questions.
Any questions? Yes.
Okay, so you have your, wave function potential in your happy little particle bouncing around in it with a definite position. Is it fair for me to presume it's going to have a definite momentum too?
What do you mean by momentum?
Well, that would, I guess, depend on how you look at it. But
do you mean mass times velocity?
For this case, sure. I mean,
if that's what you mean, you'll certainly have a definite velocity because velocity is given up there. There's the velocity.
Okay.
It'll have a definite velocity.
Maybe there'll be some relativistic constants that I'm not familiar with. But do you have a physical understanding then of why we would get an uncertainty principle?
Yeah, we'll get to that. There are many, many. All I'm saying is here is a well-defined theory. You should understand it says something. You should not understand that it has anything to do with quantum mechanics, except it somehow shares an important equation. That's not enough. So you should be puzzled about why this really is. Where do the predictions of quantum mechanics, how do you see them here? I want to elaborate on that. But yeah, you should not understand these things so far. But one more statement, yes.
It is variable highly.
Yes, that's because the positions of the particles are the hidden variables. Now, John Bell insists, and I totally agree with him, this is extremely unfortunate terminology, because the hidden variables, why is this table here? Because its hidden variable exists, the position of the table. The hidden variables are the most manifest variables in theory, and the really hidden variable is the wave function, which is not very accessible. So, yeah. It's a little strange. The hidden variable cannot be nothing exotic at all. It's just the most basic variable position.
So the big Qs.
The big Qs are the hidden variables. That's the thing you add to the wave function. Nothing exotic. Nothing requires imagination. The most obvious thing possible. People didn't arrive at Boolean mechanics because it required imagination. They didn't arrive at it because of the power of Bohr's personality. But the Broglie did, in fact, arrive at it. But because of the power of the opposition, he quickly abandoned it. It's not easy to maintain an idea when everybody's opposed to it, and particularly when you don't yourself understand it. De Broglie didn't fully understand how the theory worked. And it's only a vague idea. Bohm was the first person to appreciate how it really worked in terms of how measurements come out, things like that, quantum measurements. Yes. One last there. So let me see. Galilean covariance, which I won't give any more detail about, naturally leads to the equation of motion. And finally, there's just the most efficient summary of the experimental facts lead directly to Bohmian mechanics. What experimental facts? The facts which gave rise to quantum theory. There are many, many such facts. What is the efficient summary I have in mind? Well, the first quantum equation, the Planck equation, 1899, E equals H nu. Of course, a mysterious equation. We know one that was correct, ultimately leading some 20 years later, 25 years later, to quantum mechanics. A crucial step there was to somehow take the spatial component of that equation, E and nu are sort of time-like objects in physics. The spatial component of that equation is P equals h bar k with a Broglie relation, where k is wave vector. Its magnitude is 1 over wavelength. So this is the Broglie equation. Again, another mysterious equation, a free quantum equation. Now it is this equation relating somehow a particle property to a wave property, which contains in it enough information to arrive at Schrodinger's equation, Schrodinger evolution, as the simplest wave equation which somehow reflects that relation. And that's a standard textbook exercise. You go from there to Schrodinger's equation. And I won't do that here. Though it's not a bad thing for you to do if you've never done it. Just try to find that lesson. Find out what the simplest wave equation is that reflects. What is that suggesting to you? That's what Schrodinger did. Schrodinger was messing around, trying to look at all kinds of funny properties of waves which would fit with the Broglie's ideas, and giving a talk on it. And Peter DeBye was in the audience and said, "Hey, Schrodinger, you're being kind of silly. If you're trying to understand what the wave is like, why don't you look for a wave equation?" He saw the merit of that criticism, and he quickly found the equation. What I want to suggest here is that even more quickly, the Geiger equation emerges from this. The second equation, almost no work at all. In the following way, we have here a momentum which would naturally be thought of as mass times velocity. So velocity is h bar over m times something. What do we have over here? H bar over m times something. Now what is the something? It's k. K is some wave property, some functional of the wave function, the k. Now, k is only defined for plane waves, for psi of the form e to the I k dot q, plane waves with wave vector k. This defines wave vector. Only plane waves have wave vectors, and that's the meaning of the wave vector, wave of that form. Now the question would be, what general operation applied to this? What's the simplest general operation applied to this, to a wave function, which in this special case needs to k? Well, you have to take a derivative, a gradient, k comes down. You still have this thing, so you divide by psi, and it's canceled, you just left the k. The general operation which would lead to k is grab psi over psi. That's form equation of mode. So it's child's play to get Bohmian mechanics from p equals h bar k, almost from e equals h nu. This is a really pregnant experimental summary of information. You have to know what to focus on when you want to formulate a theory. If you look at the brute experimental facts and their grand variety, you'll get nowhere. At least you have to be a Heisenberg to get somewhere. But if you look at the right mysterious equations, you can easily guess a theory. In this case, a theory in Bohmian mechanics, which in fact yields all the predictions of orthodox quantum theory. Yeah?
If we take the gradient divided by C, we find K. But it doesn't really show that K must be.
No, it doesn't. I'm just saying how one would guess this right hand side by reflecting on that. Now, there are many other choices you can make, but that's the simplest choice you can make. And if you're doing theory formation, if you're behaving like a theoretical physicist and trying to come up with a theory, you're happy if you can formulate something which is sort of sensible. You don't worry about whether I could have formulated something else. There's never going to be a unique choice in theory formation. There might be a unique best choice. You hope there is. Yes?
Just on that point, to start, the important point you did at the Fitzgerald Congress was to say, well, if I have a plain wave like that, that then equal of that is corresponding to the classical limit, and in a way that's associated with the Hamilton Jenkins equation, where you do have mass times velocity as the gradient of s.
Yes.
Or if you want to put it another way, if I was just saying, look, for a plane wave, you know, we've got mass times velocity as gradient of phase, and then he said, and this is almost a quote, he says, well, let's proceed by induction and assume that the same velocity formula is true even for a wave that is not a plane wave. So
that's more or less what I said, although it wasn't where it really said it that way. Yeah. There are many other ways. If you look at Bohm's papers, it's not quite do it like this. But if you're imaginative, you probably can think of about four other ways that I never thought of for deriving this equation. It simply emerges. Doesn't require much imagination. I consider that sort of a miracle that all the roads lead to that equation.
Okay. Maybe, will this thing go, is it possible to put on the transparency?
Yeah.
How does this work?
Well, we've got a group that is down with you.
Well, maybe it doesn't matter. Just want to put on a two-slip transparency. It's on? Maybe I should just hold it up. That was almost there.
Oh, you're so close.
Could the technician come down? We need some help with the projector.
Yeah, come on.
All I have to say is this slide better be worth it.
Yeah, I'm worried about that. Okay, so I told you the theory. I told you how you could have probably invented it yourself. It's good to know what the trajectory, have some idea what the trajectories are like, in particular in one of the most important quantum mechanical experiments, the two-slit experiment. So that's what you see here, trajectories for the two-slit experiment. So this is a one-particle system. You see many trajectories because you're considering a large but finite number of different starting points in the slit. Of course, I think the theory is deterministic. If it's a given starting point, the wave function is fixed here, a normal two-slit wave function. Different starting points lead to different trajectories. You basically choose the starting points more or less uniformly distributed, equally distributed across the slits. No particular interesting probability distribution built in. But notice that the trajectories first start out going fairly straight, but just downfield enough where the wave function would start to, the piece of the wave function from the left slit would start overlapping with the piece of the wave function from the right slit, and exactly the situation where you would expect to have interference. where the wave functions develop an interference profile, where the wave functions become complicated. This complication is imposed on the trajectories, and the pattern of trajectory seems to develop a similar kind of profile, with particles tending to come in certain places and avoiding other places, so that it's sort of an interesting non-uniform probability distribution develops more or less as you would expect from the probability formula of psi squared. Now, how is it in Bohmian mechanics, unlike Feynman's criticism of or talk about puzzling situations? If I had only one slit open, you know there's no interference pattern. So the behavior of these particles somehow is such that they behave differently when both slits are open than when one slit is open. Why on earth should that be? How does a particle go into the left slit know whether or not the right slit is open? The answer is immediate here, because its motion is governed by the wave function. And the wave function has two pieces, one going through the left slit and one going through the right slit. And even if the particle goes through the left slit, as soon as a piece from the right slit starts to overlap with a piece from the left slit, the particle knows about both slits, about both pieces of wave function, and behaves accordingly. Nothing puzzling at all about interference from a Bohmian perspective. I'll turn this on. Yeah?
Can you show like a toy solution of the equations?
Equations? No. There are defined solutions in Holland's book of the equations. Even toy solutions. They're trivial toy solutions, but for anything interesting, I get too slick or too complicated to write down on in a short time.
Oh, like a three
degree. Yeah, and for a plane wave. What would you get for a plane wave? Three far of a plane wave, the usual kind of thing to consider plane wave motion. There you get something totally uninteresting. Particle moves with constant velocity with exactly the mass times the velocity given by h bar k, which is supposed to be the momentum. So you just get sort of the obvious thing. Free particle behaves like a free particle, moves with constant velocity with just the usual momentum. Nothing the least bit surprising, nothing the least bit interesting. Yeah.
Okay, so that's all well and good. And I know if I cover one of the slits that it makes total sense to me that I get the sort of classical or quantum one slit deal going on. But what I want to ask about is, I also know that if I take my two slits, right, in the two slit experiment, and I put a detector of one, that I should never get any interference going through it. And in general, I get that kind of effect, where the measurement collapses the wave function in sort of orthodox interpretation will change how the outcome works. And why would that be the case here? It's not immediately obvious to me why that would happen.
It's not immediately obvious, and it's an excellent question. And I hope by the time we're finished, probably not today, you'll know the answer. But it's an excellent question. One of the most puzzling things, indeed, about the two-slit experiment is why measurement, when you try to trick the thing, just figure out which slit it went through, why it destroyed, just looking at the thing, which slit the electron goes through destroys the effect, destroys the interference effect. Given the close to knowledge. Knowledge seems to have a profound effect. That is a fact about the two-slit experiment. It's an experimental fact. It has to be explained by any theory accounting for the phenomena. So it better be explained by this theory. And putting that transparency on doesn't do it. Now, all of you know the theory well enough to answer the question, as a matter of fact. So while the answer is not obvious, since I told you the whole theory, you can figure out the answer. So now you can take that as a homework problem, but it's a hard homework problem. Yeah?
I have a similar question. Usually in the normal theory, if you send only one particle, you'll still get interference, whereas in this theory, I don't see how it would work.
No, when you send only one particle, you don't see interference. You see a dot. You see a spot somewhere, just like in this theory, that you see a dot. The interference pattern is what happens when you accumulate lots and lots of dots, one here, you need lots of particles to see the interference pattern. They don't have to be in the setup at one time, you can send them through one at a time, but you can't see the probability distribution, psi squared, without lots of dots. What would it mean to see it with a single dot? One of the puzzling things about the two-slit experiment is it seems we're dealing with a particle. Unlike with light, you have a wave coming in, it spreads out, it's big in some places, weak, small in other places. One shot, you've got a pattern. But with particles, even quantum particles, with one shot, we know we get a dot somewhere. That's just standard quantum mechanics. Dot somewhere. You can't see the probabilities with one particle. You need lots of them. Even if you wait many years to have enough particles, you still need lots of them. Yeah.
I'm not sure I think that criticism is fair, because I mean, sure, you need lots of particles to see the distribution, but it's not like we're saying these particles are somehow communicating with each other over time and saying, oh, well, I went there, so you next week have to go over here, right? Like, the phenomena exists for one particle. We just can't see it until we have many.
I don't know what you mean by the phenomenon exists, but the experimental fact doesn't exist, and it's the experimental fact which has to be explained. Now, I'm not saying I've explained it. I'm saying if you look at what these trajectories suggest, they do suggest a certain pattern like the two-state experiment. It's the experimental facts which need to be explained, not our intuitions about those facts. So you may have an intuition that something like a psi-squared thing is visible for a single particle. I don't quite know what that's an intuition of. It's certainly not visible for a single particle. But the experimental fact involves many, many particles. Yeah?
What about the non-locality of psi? Why do you just, you know, take that as being okay? Is it because you're saying this is not relativistic? Everything, you only have the Galilean covariance, so it's okay that the particle knows about
this? I say it's okay for the following reason. I'm trying to, look, quantum mechanics is a strange theory. It has lots of strange features. I think the least strange thing about the Copenhagen interpretation would be non-locality. Measurement creates reality, I find much stranger. But the real answer to your question is about the non-locality, and maybe I'll get to it next time, is you better have non-locality because it's an experimental fact, as Bell has demonstrated, and Osprey's experiment. I think non-locality is a fact, so the theory would be wrong if it didn't yield the non-locality. I haven't even explained that this is non-local, and I don't know if I want to do that right now, but the theory is non-local. Maybe I shouldn't do that now. Now let me make some statements which I will not justify today. Some of them I won't justify at all. Let's see, what can come down? I just gotta get the sugar. Yeah. What is the relationship I want to begin to address? What is the relationship between Bohmian mechanics and orthodox quantum theory? They satisfy this relation. This quiddle me here means empirical. Empirical equivalence. They make the same predictions about the results of experiments. That's a fact. A very similar statement, slightly different flavor. This is sort of a symmetrical relationship between Bohmian mechanics and orthodox quantum theory. They have something in common, namely their predictions. It's an important thing to have in common. A similar statement is the following. Bohmian mechanics implies all of textbook quantum theory. You can derive all of textbook quantum theory from Bohmian mechanics. That's a fact, too. This is not a symmetrical relationship. You cannot derive Bohmian mechanics from textbook quantum theory. Now, I want to flesh this out a little bit by mentioning consequences of Bohmian mechanics. Many of these consequences have merely followed from the empirical equivalence, but some of them are best thought of directly in their own terms, rather than in terms of what follows from orthodox quantum theory. Here are some of the consequences. I guess the first thing I'll mention is for its historical significance in the history of quantum mechanics. It's one of the key questions that quantum mechanics is formed to answer, namely the pattern of spectral lines, the Rydberg formula. These spectral lines only emerge with some certain amount of difficulty from our usual analysis. Let me not go into that. One of the consequences of Bohmian mechanics is it explains the spectrum lines. You really understand it by analyzing this theory of spectrum lines. I don't will not have time to go into that. Notice that in this theory, there was nothing said. I said nothing in the formulation of this theory about operators as observables, which played a crucial role in orthodox quantum theory. So it should be puzzling how you could have this equivalence when there is no operators as observables here. So one of the consequences of Bohmian mechanics is you get operators. You understand how operators as observables, the usual stuff in textbook quantum theory, emerges from Bohmian mechanics.
I guess these 2 points are related, because once you have identified Hermitian operators with certain observables, then spectral lines are the eigenvalues, all the differences from the eigenvalues.
Yeah, but it's the differences which don't play that role. That's a tricky thing in your life. It's not quite the difference. It actually doesn't follow from any simple principle without doing a lot more work and taking the electric field into account.
In the Bohmian?
No, in the usual theory. Yeah, you always talk about fire. Yeah, that's why I don't really think of that as a simple consequence, a straightforward consequence of the usual theory. It doesn't follow from any clear principle of orthodox quantum theory applied directly to the atom itself, as you might. You have to think it does, but it does. Precisely because it's the differences which are crucial. And the differences are not the eigenvalues. Let's talk about it further. So differences of eigenvalues, something else. Scattering theory is an important subject for quantum mechanics. And it achieves a remarkable clarity, possibility of a real derivation of scattering theory from first principles from Bohmian mechanics, in a sense which it cannot be done in the usual theory. I'm actually struck by how clean the derivation of scattering theory from microscopic first principles becomes in Bohmian mechanics. A lot of hard mathematics has to be done, but it's very clean and nice. I won't talk about that. What I will say something about, one of the consequences of Bohmian mechanics is, famously, the collapse of the wave function. The collapse rule. When you do suitable measurements, call them measurements of a certain observable, quantum observable, the wave function is supposed to collapse. According to Bohmian mechanics, it does. Now, if you've been listening, you should be really puzzled by that. Because I emphasize that in Bohmian mechanics, unlike orthodox quantum theory, you don't have extra rules which tell you that the Schrodinger evolution should be violated in certain situations. According to this theory, that's a fundamental, Schrodinger equation is a fundamental equation. So how can I also tell you that as a consequence of the theory, wave functions sometimes collapse? That should be puzzling. Now, I can leave that as a homework exercise, too, but that would be much too hard. So that's something I do want to explain. And one last consequence I want to mention of Bohmian mechanics is absolute uncertainty / you might think of the uncertainty principle / quantum randomness. Here we have, with Bohmian mechanics, a totally deterministic theory. So where could quantum randomness possibly come from in this theory? That should be puzzling. So I'll say a few words about that, but that's a long and controversial story. But I hope I can at least say enough for you to appreciate that at least it's not so implausible that in the deterministic theory, something like randomness should emerge. This randomness is a very strong character, though. There is an absolute uncertainty. I have to explain what that means. And maybe I should do that now. Just what do I mean by the absolute uncertainty? Here's the fact. Just an elaboration of what I mean by absolute uncertainty. The typical Bohmian universe is in quantum equilibrium. Now, quantum equilibrium has to be explained. That it means roughly, somehow, having rho equals psi squared probabilities. The Bohmian universe in quantum equilibrium is one with absolute uncertainty, in which it is impossible in this universe to know more about a system than its wave function allows. That is, more than the quantum probability distribution psi squared. You can't know more than the psi squared distribution. That's what I mean by absolute uncertainty. So, for example, I have a particle with a wave function like that. I'm saying nothing you can do can get you into a situation where you have that wave function that you actually know. That's the wave function. It is the wave function of the system, as I drew it. But you know the particle is well localized. That's impossible. That information is impossible for a typical Bohmian universe. That's sort of a consequence of the analysis of this theory, that there are strong limitations in what it is possible to know in a Bohmian universe. Yes?
What do you mean by a typical Bohmian universe?
I mean, yeah, that's a difficult notion. But I mean, there are, in some sense, of most Bohmian universes, there are, I mean, typicality in the same sense of the following. It happens to be a fundamental principle of thermodynamics that entropy typically increases. Exceptions would be rare, so rare that if anybody proposes a perpetual motion machine, we just don't believe them. Things which are, I mean, so atypical means something as rare as impossible almost, as a perpetual motion machine. They're not impossible, they're extremely rare. You are surprised if somebody comes up with one. Yeah?
Can I just make a general comment? So David Wallace, when he started his talks on Everett, he said something like, you know, there are as many versions of Everett as there are workers on the Everett. So, I think it's fair for the students to say that there's a similar thing in Breuer-Bohm. So, I mean, one point about that there are many, still many people like Peter Holland who wouldn't write the theory in first quantum form. They like the equation with accelerations, which is what Bohm is. That's what we'll find in Bohm's papers. There's still people who disagree about what's the best way to write the equation. But on this point about probability, you know, it's also fair to say this is a controversial issue. So Shelley has a certain view about using typicality as a basic concept. Other people, such as myself, take a different view, which you'll hear about when I give some talks in March. And here we're touching on really tricky issues in the foundations of statistical mechanics, which people have been arguing about for 100 years, and Shelley and I are still arguing.
But on this particular point, which I've only enunciated rather vaguely, I don't even think we disagree about what I've said here. I mean, we disagree on final points, but it's the question of how one understands a statement. But I don't really believe that what I've said here is in conflict with anything you believe.
Maybe you even disagree about that.
we should discuss it, not flash.
So the question is that the statement of AU related to Born's rule?
Yes, it's absolutely related. It says it's equivalent to Born's rule in the following sense. It says Born's rule is almost as an absolute character. It says that you should, if in fact we're in quantum, we are in a universe in quantum equilibrium, if we're in a certain kind of universe, then it's not a question of being clever enough to defeat Born's rule. You won't be able to. No matter what technological progress is made, you will not overcome. You will not be able to know more than the psi squared distribution.
Wasn't the aim of this program to remove the measurement axiom?
There is no axiom here, but I have not added a measurement axiom. I've made a statement about what about a statement of a consequence of the analysis of this theory. It's a statement which, just a blanket statement, it's not a maxim. I'm not, one doesn't make this as an axiom. It would be, I would find the theory utterly unacceptable if I had to add such an axiom. I wouldn't even know what I meant. It's not an axiom. It's a somewhat vague statement of a consequence of this particular theory. That in fact, the uncertainty principle and all the quantum randomness of an absolute character emerges.
Given this, wouldn't it be fair to say that the positions are in a sense hidden variables, but sometimes they're hidden only by cellophane?
So hidden by what?
Well, I mean, like if a wave function is almost a spike, then the positions are in effect manifest. Very, very, basically to within very high precision. But yet all you can learn about is the amplitude squared of the wave function, and then you can't actually learn about precise positions.
There are limitations about what you can learn in positions. Absolutely right. But on the other hand, there is no measurement problem, unlike the usual theory. I mean, there are positions, which, like the weight pointer's point, which are clear. You look at a pointer, and it's a Bohmian orientation which you have for the pointer. You see it. You know it. Whereas in usual theory, you have a spread-out wave function. So it, part of the problem here is, and it's a fundamental issue which I need to get to, what do I mean by this wave function which is collapsing in contradiction to that rule? So,
I'm actually not so worried about the collapse at this point. It's just a comment on your comment that calling the positions hidden variables is extremely unfortunate use of terminology. And in the sense that you can't actually learn, in a large number of cases, the actual position, they are in a sense hidden. It's just that sometimes the distributions are so narrow that they are effectively not hidden.
They're certainly sometimes hidden. There's no question about that. That's what I'm saying. They are sometimes hidden, but they're not exotic. And on the macroscopic level, they're not hidden. And it's not just microscopic positions that are added to Schrodinger's equation. Macroscopic level, they're added as well. They're certainly not hidden. Yeah?
I think also that would be fair to the student. I mean, some people would argue that in addition to the two axioms, the two equations of motion, that you're also adding an axiom saying that the measure of cyclicality on initial conditions is given by the modulus squared of the wave function for the whole universe. I mean, people, you might not agree with that way of putting it, but a number of people would say that.
That's a situation analogous to the one in classical statistical mechanics, whether you have an extra axiom or not. And yes, I hope to get to that as well. But the status of such an axiom is tenuous. It's difficult to pin it down. I think, time to stop? Okay.
All right, well, thank you again.
You put together a pretty good list of positive features about Bohmian mechanics, and some of them I really like to see before I fully buy them, but let's say that's great. Can you give maybe some impression of what the case against it, or what problems might still be sitting there?
I would say
fringe fields, but have these small quality of dust, because all this has no problems.
There are certainly issues, but the issues don't explain the reaction to it, I think. To understand the reaction to it, you have to understand the history of quantum mechanics, the power of Bohr, his personality, the intimidation.
Yeah, that's fair, but to hear some of these issues just before we go to think about.
Now, what are some of the legitimate problems here? Okay. Some of the problems are problems you would have with orthodox quantum theory, but still, this theory has. So it wouldn't really answer your question, but it's a fundamental question. What kind of strange thing is this wave function? It's a puzzling thing. And it's, in some sense, a bigger problem for Bohmian mechanics in the sense that the wave function is somehow, you have to take it really seriously, where in orthodox quantum theory, you can pretend it's not really important. It's not clear what's important. It's not so clear what the commitments are. Mm-hmm. So there's the issue of what is the status of the wave function. There's also the issue of extending this to other kinds of physics, quantum field theory, making it relativistic, which is really hard to do. So if you think relativity is a force, the Lorentz invariance, that's a real challenge. I think those are the real issues. How do you extend it to quantum gauge theories, other theories in a satisfactory way? I don't think the non-relativistic theory has, to me, it doesn't really have any genuine physics difficulties issues which would explain the reaction to it. There are some subtle philosophical questions which are going to be involved in any kind of deep analysis of the theory. That's something else. That wouldn't explain it either. For example, most of the reaction of most physics, what kind of objections do you hear from time to time? Well, you often hear that this theory is clearly wrong because it just contradicts the results of quantum mechanics. Can't work. There's no hidden variable theories. Prove it's impossible. Very common reaction. No hidden variable theories. Prove it's impossible. When you tell the person they don't really do that, they say, okay, I don't really care about the theory. It's no good because it makes the same predictions as orthodox quantum theory. That's a very common objection. It makes the same prediction, so why should I care? It's the same theory. I shouldn't care about it. One objection to it is that it's non-local. The problem with that objection is that quantum mechanics is non-local. And many are. You have any other objections, Anthony? I mean, there's a whole slew of them. There's a long list of objections. Most of them have little force. Some of them, I told you the ones I think are significant. Extensions, serious extensions. But I don't think there's no merit to the objection if the theory doesn't work.
Well, there is the objection to, I mean, I think it's being raised here, that look, there are, I mean, from my point of view, if you have this idea of that you only look at this theory of the size field distribution, okay, if the initial positions of the particles are chosen in a certain way, such that you always get psi squared in the future, then it is the case that, generally speaking, no experiment you can do can detect the details of the trajectory. Then the theory predicts the trajectory look like this. You can't really check that. Now, I think for a lot of physicists, they're bothered by that. It seems to them that, well, this theory has structure in it that is in principle unverifiable observationally. And that's a common objection.
It is a common objection, but it's also often physicists who say, look, the usual theory has all these conceptual difficulties. If they agree that these difficulties are resolved by the theory, for example, now I understand collapse, which you should from the theory. I haven't explained that to you, but there is no measurement problem. It's hard for me to see how that kind of objection could counter the removal of all those really profound conceptual difficulties in the usual theory, which are responsible for the fact that we have this series of lectures. We wouldn't have it, there wouldn't be the series of lectures, I suspect, if the Bohmian formulation was the thing which originally caught on rather than the Copenhagen interpretation. People wouldn't be arguing about what quantum theory says. They would know what that theory says.
you have more stuff here than usual quantum theory,
In a sense, no. In a sense, it's simpler because you don't really have more stuff. Because instead of the equation of motion for the configuration in Bohmian mechanics that you have in Bohmian mechanics, you have all the measurement axioms in the orthodox theory, and that's where all the linear algebra and functional analysis, spectral measures, come in. And that's pretty complicated stuff. Physical conceptually, and I would say mathematics, one extra equation instead of a whole slew of measurement axioms.
Isn't A in some sense measurement?
It's a measurement consequence, not a measurement axiom. It's a constant.
Yes, it's
a tricky thing, as Anthony rightly pointed out. But it more or less follows in the same way that similar statements follow in statistical mechanics. It's not an axiom. You certainly wouldn't take that as an axiom. That'd be a crazy axiom. It's hard to clear what it means. Trying to give you some of the bit of a flavor of what absolute uncertainty means. You really can't defeat rho equals psi squared. But to make that, if that were taken as an axiom of the theory, I would say the theory is unacceptable. But if at the end of the day I can understand why that's true, and that's the assertion I made, and you can understand why this is true in Bohmian mechanics, that's thoroughly acceptable. Then you can explain one of the most striking features of quantum mechanics, why you have unavoidable probabilities in these theories.
Why do you say it's unacceptable?
Can I remember? It's really a strange kind of axiom about how can you have axiom about what you could observe? I mean, how could that be on a fundamental level? Physics doesn't care about those things.
I'm not sure if I understand. Is this making a wave with superpositions? Are particles never in superposition?
Wave functions are in superpositions. So if you think in quantum mechanics as the thing that's in superpositions are wave functions, and you have the same wave functions, then you have superpositions in exactly that sense. Now, particles are only where they are, so they're not in two places at once. But the waves are what they were before, therefore sometimes in superposition. For example, in the two-slit experiment, the wave in the two-slit experiment, if there's going to be interference at all, has to be a superposition of pieces coming through one slit and a piece coming through the other slit, superposition of two pieces. But the particle doesn't go through both slits, it goes through one or the other. So the particle, in a sense, is not in a superposition, but the wave is in the usual way.
So if I have a spin 1/2, you wouldn't say that it could be in a superposition of up and down?
The wave could, but not the particle. There is actually no extra degree of freedom introduced for the particle. You might have thought to deal with spin, you should introduce, in addition to the translational degrees of freedom, the positions, you should introduce discrete degrees of freedom corresponding to spin. So the state would be given not just by the positions of the particles, but by the discrete values of the spin variables. What I've described here is you do no such thing. It's still the fundamental, still the particle is described only by its position and the wave function. Now, the wave function, they then have lots of components. That's where spin comes in. But you don't change the nature of the particle, something which has extra discrete degrees of freedom. You don't do that. You don't need to do any such thing to deal with spin.
What do you think this has to say about quantum computation, or vice versa? What do you think quantum computation, or you assume, or you, people usually think of, the system being in superpositions?
Yeah, I would say it certainly totally, I think it thoroughly illuminates quantum computation. It shows how the results of quantum computation involve nothing mysterious at all. But it's clear from the mathematics of quantum computation that it all arises from the nature of the tensor product structure which we're dealing with for states in quantum mechanics, wave functions. Now, that tensor product structure, wave functions in quantum mechanics, have been given a clear role in this theory. And so you wouldn't really change the story with this theory if you applied it to quantum computation. You do the same analysis, but then you would end up, why you end up with definite results. Because the definite results were recorded on ink marks on paper or something like that, and that could be something configuration. Yeah?
Following on from that, I'm a physicist, so I'm used to thinking about particles in superposition, spin up and spin down. You're now saying that the wave is doing this. What physically do you view the wave as in the mechanics?
That's an important question. A wave is some strange kind of reality, as it in fact is an orthodox quantum theory. You have this wave function. It's an abstract kind of thing. It has many components for spin. It's more puzzling than that. It's on configuration space. To me, that's the characteristic feature of quantum mechanics, that it involves a strange kind of object, a wave function, not on a physical space, which you can regard as some real spread out field kind of thing. Some reality on physical space, like a density of stuff. But you have some kind of stuff that I think that's probably an unfortunate way to put it, on configuration space. That's a strange kind of thing. But that's what Bohmian mechanics has in common with orthodox quantum theory. What it adds is not strange at all. But there are interesting things to say about what the significance of the wave function is for Bohmian mechanics. But at this very moment is not the right time to say it. Yeah.
We're almost convinced that Bohmian mechanics is not worse than quantum mechanics.
It's what?
Not worse. But it's really better, or more precisely. Is it applicable to find an, let's say, experimental setup, which or problem which could be solved by the Bohmian mechanics and which could not be solved by the other?
Yes. Now, if there were quantum non-equilibrium, as Valentini, as Antony hopes, and it's certainly a real possibility, then there would be a possibility of experimental discrimination. In quantum equilibrium, there would not be, but even that is a tricky subject. There are certain experiments whose analysis in Bohmian mechanics is crystal clear. And it's the correct analysis. And it's something which, after great length, ordinary quantum physicists would also do, but the principles he'd be invoking wouldn't be very clear. So there are, but there's no deviation. But there are no contradictions either. In orthodox quantum theory,
we don't get much.
You gain understanding, though.
Okay.
You gain understanding. You know, for all practical purposes, as Bell would say, orthodox quantum theory is just fine. And I think you're talking about for all practical purposes. But if you're talking about really understanding what the theory is saying and how its axioms fit together and what they really say, the gain is immense. For example, as I will explain next time, you understand, you derive collapse in Bohmian mechanics, something which just seems like a contradiction in the orthodox theory, you just simply derive in Bohmian mechanics. That's an immense gain of understanding.
Question. The question of conceptually gaining from the interpretation. I'd be more convinced that if there was evidence of people coming up with kind of breakthroughs in physics, new ideas about musical theory, new ways to solve problems that don't work in a conventional framework. I'm sure there's nothing more confused by collapse, and that slows them down. You have the correct understanding of collapse, and you don't have all the propositions. But are there any examples of people actually making progress that was inspired by the conceptual issues in Bohmian mechanics?
Yeah, I don't know. I would be inclined to say no, but I might actually be glad to hear.
Bell says himself that they were studying mechanics.
Yeah, but his insights were about constraints on realism. It's not like practical predictions in the lab.
Well, non-locality could be taken as a prediction. In fact, Bell first noticed the non-locality in Bohmian mechanics. It could have been the case, but it wasn't. So it's not a good example. But it could have been the case that quantum computing was inspired not by many worlds, but by Bohmian mechanics. Because what's essential to quantum computing is don't be like Bohr, take the wave function seriously. And you sure as hell have to take it seriously in Bohmian mechanics. If you take it seriously, you've got quantum computing. Now you want something more, and I would like there to be more. But here's a basic fact. Students should realize that if they work and go into foundations of quantum mechanics, their job prospects are less than they would otherwise be. And if they go into Bohmian mechanics, they're probably much less still. Therefore, there's not likely to be the number of excellent students working the field which would be required, which might be helpful for that kind of thing.
All right, well, with that, let's...
I could have a well-defined theory, a different theory, a long time.